This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 174, Klingon Courting for Dummies. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Matthew Rushing. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including a special honor for Star Trek Communicator founder Dan Madsen, and the upcoming release of the Wrath of Khan Steelbook. Then in the feature, we're joined by Will Wynn to discuss the DS9 episode, Looking for Parmach in All the Wrong Places. So let's step into The Ready Room. Hello, Matthew. Thanks for joining me once again here on The Ready Room. It's becoming a regular thing. Apparently, it's either you or it's Larry here with me the past 4 or 5 weeks. How's everything going?
Well, Chris, it's going great. Today, I'm trying some Klingon beer, the Klingon Warthog. And
I saw that.
Yeah, I've got to say, it's pretty good. I really enjoy it. So,
is it?
Yeah, it actually is pretty good. You know, anytime you see those beers or something like that that's based off a show,
right,
or something,
exactly,
you're like,
yeah,
eh.
Yeah.
Like, I have a bottle of Romulan ale from the Star Trek Experience, and I never got to visit, but a friend of mine got me a bottle, and I've never opened it, and apparently it's just blue beer, so I have no idea if it was any good, but this stuff
it's
is...
blue beer.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So... but apparently this stuff is and you know, obviously I'm drinking it right now. It's very, very delectable. So, you know, if you have a chance at any of your local, you know, alcoholic beverage dispensers or, you know, connoisseurs, places you can buy your alcohol and they are selling this or the Vulcan Ale, it's definitely worth trying. And I really do recommend Klingon Warthog to everyone. So,
okay, interesting. Yeah. And by the way, everyone, this is not a paid promotional spot or anything
nope.
like that. Matthew is actually just drinking this beer.
And
I was curious because, like you said, Matthew, it's one of those things where I'm very hesitant when I see something like that because... typically, products that are tied into something are usually the product itself isn't very good. It's just the tie-in that they're selling. But so you're saying this actually is pretty good beer.
I've tried the Vulcan one now, and I've also tried this Klingon one because I'm drinking it right now. And I have to say that I like the Klingon one better. The Vulcan one is not bad. It's a red ale, obviously, for the red Vulcan planet. And so, but yeah, Klingon beer. Not bad. It makes me feel like Martok. So
okay, all right. But you don't have to cut your hand before drinking the Warthog beer.
You know, I think that they do cut their hand and they put a little bit of blood in there before they drink
it. Really?
And that's what makes it blood beer. But yeah, I did not do that. I'm not crazy. So
okay, all right. Well, let's go ahead and get into our news here. We have two items we're going to talk about today. The first one I'm going to talk about is not exactly news in that it apparently happened in April of last year, but it is news in that it was just published on StarTrek.com. And this is the fact that Dan Madsen, who many listeners know as the founder of the official Star Trek fan club, was honored in Colorado for his work on the Communicator magazine, and just developing the fan club over the years. He actually received a certificate of commendation from Colorado State Representative Paul Rosenthal, who Dan says is a huge Star Trek fan himself.
This is really, really cool. You know, I think it's just amazing the way that Star Trek has influenced life in general. You know, not just popular culture or anything like that, but the scientific culture and even obviously the political culture now with Dan Mattson being honored by a Colorado state representative. I think it's just fabulous the way that Star Trek is able to touch people's lives in many different areas of life. And that it shows the validity, I think, of Star Trek and its storytelling for not just the scientific community, but for just people in general. And I love that this happened. And I think, you know, for a guy like Dan, who has done so much for the Star Trek community, bringing that to people and helping it be okay to be a fan in the way that he did, you know, with founding the Star Trek official fan club in 1980. And of course, then Star Trek Communicator, which I got so many years ago, you know, back in the day. I loved Star Trek Communicator.
I've got like every issue around here.
It's just awesome. So I really like to see this. And obviously, you know, this happened last year, but I can't imagine it happening to a better guy.
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah. And Dan wrote a piece on StarTrek.com, which was published just a few, maybe, I think it was maybe last week, kind of got overshadowed with everything else that's been going on, which is one reason why I wanted to talk about it here on the show today and draw everyone's attention to this. And he was talking about Star Trek and what it's meant to him and what it's meant to others in the piece. And one thing he said was that it has inspired me to strive for something better. Many lives and career choices have been profoundly changed or positively affected as a result of Star Trek. Those in multiple careers and daily life, as well as politics, science, medicine, etc. I have met legions of fans who have remarkably uplifting stories of how Star Trek pulled them out of despair, gave them a new outlook, and helped them choose their path. And that's something we hear too from people, Matthew, here on the network. And the show that gets the most feedback like that is actually To the Journey. Tristan and Char hear from a lot of readers who talk about how Voyager helped them at critical moments in their life and how the character of Janeway helped them as well. And I love, you know, I get all the mail that comes into the network as a publisher, and there are days, and this is a thank you that I want to send out there to all the fans and all the listeners, that there are days where, you know, work is hard and I'm very tired, and getting these shows recorded and edited can sometimes be very stressful and tiring. But then we receive a mail from someone with a comment like that about how Star Trek is important to them or how our shows help them get through their days. And it always lifts me up, because then I realize, Matthew, you know, the things that we do are really important to other people. And it's the same, you know, what Dan did over the years with the fan club and Communicator just was so important to people's everyday lives.
Chris, I can't even put any kind of reference number and, you know, anything like that of what it means when we get something like that for any of the shows that we do, you know, whether it's feedback on iTunes, a review, or just somebody writing us an email through the contact forum, or somebody contact us on Facebook, on the Babel Conference, or on our Facebook page, or through Twitter, just specifically taking one of our hosts' handles and writing them specifically. I just think it's fantastic when that kind of thing happens. And it means so much to us, because in general, I think all of us have been touched by Star Trek in some way. That's why we're a part of this. And, you know, for me, it was really resonating with Sisko's journey, especially the very first episode of Emissary, of the prophets challenging Sisko, of being stuck basically in the past. And you know, that for me was the thing that I can even still go back to, and I'm still touched by and have to be reminded of. So it is fantastic that in so many ways, with so many shows and movies, that Star Trek has an impact in our life. And what I love is that Dan is still very involved in fandom. And he's now the publicist for Ashley Eckstein's fantastic Her Universe, which has really focused on female fans and given them apparel that, one, fits them You know, for so long, female fans just had to go pull off the rack, you know,
the giant baggy t-shirts that we all get. Yeah.
And so I love that he is still involved with bringing fandom to the fans in a way that's best for them, and really focusing here on a part of fandom that had been languishing for so long because nobody paid attention to it. Our great female fans, what an amazing place to be. And so Dan is still continuing to boldly go for fans, you know, of not just Star Trek fandom, but, you know, I know her universe works for lots of different fandoms, whether it's Star Wars or Doctor Who or anything like that.
Battlestar
Galactica. So, I mean, the list is endless where they can go with that. And the fact that he's involved with that just makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, just as we, you know, we do our shows here, we cover Star Trek, we try to dig in depth into the world of Star Trek and enrich the lives of fans. And that's what Dan was doing all those years ago. He's really a pioneer in building communities around fandom, which is what we're trying to do as well. So it's just wonderful to see him receiving this honor. And I actually had Dan on Matter Stream. It's been maybe 3 years ago now or more. But if you go listen to Matter Stream 11, it's called A Lifelong Journey with Star Trek. I sat down with Dan for about an hour, and he really tells his story about how he founded the fan club, how he got into Star Trek in the first place, and how he founded the fan club. And it's really, really interesting. So if you're not familiar with Dan, maybe you know Communicator, but you don't know the story behind it and the man behind it, go check out Matter Stream 11. And congratulations to Dan for his honor. Matthew, the other thing we're going to talk about today is about a movie and about a still book, which is going to be The Wrath of Khan coming in May. News came out over on treknews.net, and I also saw this on TrekCore, that Paramount is going to be releasing a new still book of Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan on Blu-ray coming in May. And they also state erroneously that this is the first Star Trek film to be released in steelbook packaging. Now, that's actually not true. 2009 and Into Darkness were both released as steelbooks. As I understand it from doing some research, Walmart in the U.S. actually released 2009 as a steelbook. And I know that both of these films have been released that way in the U.K., Germany, France, Spain, Australia, here in Japan. I've actually got my steelbook of Into Darkness, which I'm showing you on the screen right now. It's a very nice case. But I know for the original series movies, this would be the first time. And what I like about the steelbooks is that it's not so much the packaging, although the packaging is really cool, but they often have some extra bonuses or extra features in them. They're great for collectors. The Wrath of Khan is one of those movies that's been released in, you know, different versions over time. So looking for a steelbook of The Wrath of Khan, Matthew, what would you hope to find in this collection? We don't have the details yet.
My hope would be that this is the director's cut of the film, and not just a reissue of what we saw in the original Blu-ray set that we've had, you know, reissued a few times. And you can get the film as a standalone and just a normal Blu-ray case. And so that's what I would really like to see is the director's cut be issued, because I don't really see the need for this unless we're going to give fans a reason to buy it, you know?
It needs to have something new, right?
Exactly.
So, Matthew, in the U.S. right now, you guys, to get the original series films on Blu-ray, do you have to buy that set?
You don't. You can buy them individually.
Okay, because we have them individually. We've always had them individually here in Japan.
I have noticed on iTunes, though, that you can buy the second film and the sixth film in the director's cut in an HD version on iTunes, but those have not been released specifically on Blu-ray in a standalone. And therefore, that's what I'd really like to see. If this steelbook was The Wrath of Khan in Blu-ray with the extras that came along with the set, I'd be all over this, because I don't own the films in Blu-ray, because I don't want to give up what I've, and there's no reason for me to purchase it if it's not the director's cut, even for the extras. It's just, it's not really worth it for me to spend that extra money when it's not the film version that I enjoy watching, and I'm not going to pay, you know, $14.99 or whatever just to get some extras that I'll watch maybe once.
Well, and steelbooks are usually very expensive. I mean, like this steelbook of Into Darkness in Japan, this was like $80.
Yeah, in the States here, normally a steelbook is anywhere from $9.99 to $14.99, something like that. So
that's really cheap.
Yeah, it's not that expensive. So I don't expect this one to be expensive because I think you can buy the normal Blu-ray for about, you know, $9.99 to $14.99 on like an Amazon. Okay. So I think the steelbook would probably be somewhere around that. In fact, Walmart has tons of steelbooks that are like $9.99 each. And they're just like, you know, famous films. They've just put in steelbook version. And so for those people that really love steelbooks, this is going to be a steal.
You know, my Into Darkness set here came with a miniature version of the first issue of the Countdown to Darkness comic, which I showed you on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
It would be nice. They won't do this. But imagine this, Matthew. The Wrath of Khan steelbook, if they put, even if it's a miniaturized version, Khan Ruling in Hell, the comic series from IDW in there, because that adds, for me, we've discussed this on Literary Treks before, that comic series adds so much to the film itself.
It really does. You know, when we talked about that with John Tenuto, I thought that it was a fantastic series. Very well done. The artwork was fantastic. The storyline was great. And I can't watch The Wrath of Khan now without thinking about those background elements of the Ruling in Hell series. And so I would love to see something like that. What I'm frustrated, I think, in general with Paramount is that on a whole, we're getting things like this where you're just kind of throwing things at fans. We already all have this. There's no reason for anyone to buy this, honestly, even if they just like steelbooks. And so, and I don't think it's going to get new people to necessarily buy it because...
Well, no, new fans are not going to buy a steelbook. Steelbook is going to be something bought by the diehard fan.
Again, this is different because this is Paramount and not CBS, but it's just a frustration I have with the mismanagement of the Star Trek franchise in general, and especially its film and TV marketing and what they've done with it. So it's just frustrating. It's very, very frustrating. So
I hear you. That's why I'm hoping they will do something new with it. Now, unfortunately, as is often the case with steelbooks, this is going to be available exclusively through Best Buy in the U.S. and Future Shop in Canada. Now, bringing you over here to Japan, when they do things like this, like with the Into Darkness, it was available exclusively through Amazon. So I couldn't walk into a store and pick that up. I had to actually order it. And that's kind of unfortunate. I wish they would just put stuff in every store. But at the same time, I understand that stores these days make agreements with studios for special content and such. And that's how it goes. So, you know, we will see where they go with this. It's going to be coming in May. We don't yet know what the actual price is going to be. But I'm curious to know what you would want to see in it, just like we talked about here. And you can come over to the Babel Conference and let us know there. I'm sure there is already a discussion thread about this there. And if there's not, there will be soon, no doubt. Let us know what you think about video releases, how they're handled, what you would like to see in the steelbook, and also if you're going to buy the Wrath of Khan steelbook. All right, Matthew, well, that's all we have in our news segment today, a pretty brief one here. So let's go ahead and bring in Will Wynn and talk about looking for Parmak in all the wrong places. Sometimes you work hard for love, and sometimes it's right in front of you, and you don't even see it. And both things happen in the Deep Space Nine episode, Looking for Parmak in All the Wrong Places. Today we're going to talk about this episode, and to help us do that, we're joined by one of the hosts of our Enterprise show, Warp 5. It's Will Wynn. Hey, Will. Welcome back.
Thanks. Always a pleasure to talk DS9.
Yeah, now you are a Niner, aren't you?
I am. It's my first love. I mean, obviously I love Enterprise, but Deep Space Nine is my first love. I remember watching it in high school and just absolutely falling in love with it. So any chance to talk DS9, I'm always there.
All right.
So the episode title really means something to Will because, you know, with Enterprise, he's just been looking for Parmok in all the wrong places. That's what happens when you watch the wrong show, you know?
It's true. DS9's my Dax, but I've been always just on, I'm trying to go after Enterprise, just kind of like Grilka, but yeah, pretty much nailed it with that one.
Were you thinking that on the NX-01 that the decon chamber might help you get that Parmok?
Yes. Can you imagine Quark and Worf being stuck in the decon chamber? It would be the best / worst odd couple pairing since
Odo and Quark
were
stuck in
that mountain together. Like if they were stuck together inside that room, I don't know. I'm pretty sure Quark would be dead.
That would be awesome. All right. Well, a quick synopsis of the episode for those who have not seen it or haven't seen it in a long time. And if you haven't seen it, then we want to know why. You really should have watched this episode by now, because it's one of the great, fun DS9 episodes. Grilka, a Klingon, I should say Lady Grilka, in fact, comes aboard the station, and she is Quark's ex-wife. Worf sees her and falls for her right away because she is glorious. But he did not know that she was Quark's ex-wife until Jadzia gave him the unfortunate news. The episode then plays out with Worf pursuing her while Quark is also pursuing her. And in an unexpected twist, Quark ends up getting the help of Worf to win the heart of Lady Grilka. All the while, Jadzia is dropping clues to Worf that he never picks up on until the very end, when all four of these people go into the infirmary and make Dr. Bashir very uncomfortable. That's the basics of the episode. Nothing grandiose here, just a fun story. So, Matthew, what are your first thoughts here on looking for Parmok in all the wrong places?
I think of all the shows that people think of with Star Trek, I don't think anybody would have thought that Deep Space Nine would be the one to do a romantic comedy. You know, I don't think anybody thinks about Deep Space Nine in those terms of it being so funny and lighthearted. But I mean, this episode is just, it's all about character. It's all about moving them forward and showing whole new sides of these characters and letting the actors, I think, just have fun. I mean, even in the very small scene that Sisko is in, when he's talking to Dax about the fact that, you know, Worf has seen this hot beauty, you know, and that he's in love and he's, you know, stranger things have happened, you know, especially here on the station. It's just everybody's having a great time with this episode. And that's really just what I love about this whole thing is that it really lets the cast just kind of let loose and play around. And again, it really is like for anybody who's a fan of just goofy, off the wall, romantic comedy type of things, this is the perfect episode for that. Like if you're going to bring your girlfriend into Deep Space Nine, this might be one of the first episodes you show her or your boyfriend, you know, if he's into those kind of films. You know, this is the episode that really lets you know that this show has a lot of heart, it's a lot of fun, and it has great characters. And of course, you can go back and watch all the rest. But that's one of the best parts about this is it is probably one of the most enjoyable Star Trek episodes from start to finish. And I mean, you don't have to have seen every little bit and piece of every episode of that series to really enjoy this one. And I think that's what makes it such a standout, and especially for Deep Space Nine, where people always, you know, ding it for being the dark and gritty one. Well, sometimes, but in the other times, it's one of the funniest Star Treks. And I think this episode really goes a long way to showing that.
What do you think, Will? Do you think that DS9 is one of the funniest Star Treks when it decides to do a comedy?
Oh, yeah, I think so. And I think because of its format and because of the wide cast that it has in terms of supporting characters, its deep bench, it allows it to almost just think of it kind of like using different combinations, because there are so many different combinations that are available with so many supporting characters, and because it's on a station, people can come and go, you can have the ability to have really interesting mix-ups. Like, who would have thought that Grilka, Quark, Worf, and Jadzia, just in the A-plot, you know, that combination would be so strong that it could carry an entire episode, let alone, you know, the really great B-plot, too, with Kira and the O'Briens. And I think because of its unique format, it allows it to be able to tell a surprisingly funny romantic comedy story. And I think people forget that this is a sequel to House of Quark. So they already did a type of romantic comedy. They already introduced those elements already, and they just build upon it and just take it to the next level with this episode.
Yeah, but I think this episode really stands above House of Quark in terms of quality of the story and just being a fun episode.
Oh, yeah. I totally agree. Yeah.
But as Memory Alpha refers to this, this is part two of the Quark and Grilka arc.
Yeah, I never thought about that before. Like, has its own classification.
I know, right?
Like, remember the Dewey Decimal System? Like, I can just imagine someone in Memory Alpha, like, literally putting the cards together of, like, this is the Quark and Grilka arc. Let's file this under a specific section, and everything is... Like, you think the Dominion arc is an arc? No, there's going to be like 10 smaller arcs than that big arc, yeah. Right?
Well, I think the actors themselves, I mean, Armin Shimerman can play comedy so well, and Michael Dorn does a great job with comedy also, which you don't think about because Worf is such a serious character throughout the series. But for subtle comedy, Michael Dorn is really great. And of course, Terry Farrell is great at comedy. So you put the three of them together, working together, and it's the perfect recipe for a fun episode.
Well, and even then, just having the episode, you know, you kind of start with Bashir in the corridor there, kind of lurking around the O'Brien's quarters. You get the feeling like he was going to go over and say hi to Miles, and then here's this fighting, and you know, like the whole thing that, and every time he's in this episode, I mean, he's just hysterical because of the way he's needling characters like O'Brien or just the deadpan delivery at the very end. I mean, everybody here is just on top of their comedic game. There's nobody here, I think, giving a bad performance or something that's pulling you out of the episode being like, oh, that guy's not funny. You know, it's just, that's what's so fantastic, I think, about the episode is from start to finish, it is just a hoot.
Talking about comedy, I mean, even Odo, when he asks Kira, which part? You know?
The way René Auberjonois is smiling, the way he's smiling so widely
through the
makeup,
it's
almost like a Joker smile. He's just enjoying it so much. Like, I've never seen Odo smile that widely. It was a little freaking, like, whoa, he's really enjoying this.
He was going for his full-on flocks, but he couldn't quite get there.
Yeah, no one can do the full flocks.
That sounds so dirty.
Oh, I guess it does. Well, you know, one thing that always stands out for me in this episode is that it is like the classic story of Cyrano de Bergerac, but in reverse, because you've actually got Worf helping Quark win the heart of the lady here, which, you know, we are dealing with aliens here, so I guess it depends on which species you are as to who you would feel is the more attractive of the two, but it just always strikes me as... It being, you know, it's Worf who wants Grilka, and he can't have her. And he can't believe that she's interested in Quark, and he thinks that it's shameful for a Ferengi to be courting her. In fact, the best line about that in this episode is delivered by Jackie Chiles. You know, the lawyer on Seinfeld, Kramer's lawyer. Who told you to use a bomb? Do you know what a bomb is? It's outrageous. The same actor... playing this part here. It's Phil Morris. And if you don't know, that's Phil Morris as the Klingon here. When he says, this consorting with the Ferengi, it's outrageous. That's Jackie Chiles right there.
Wow, I did not know that.
Thopok is space Jackie Chiles.
That's fantastic. That's glorious.
I love that line. But anyway, so Worf, he doesn't like this, but he's decided he is going to help Quark, because if he can't have Grilka himself, he can at least use his knowledge of Klingon culture to win her heart via proxy through Quark.
I loved that fact that Worf takes that challenge. Like, you know, and
he's like Barney. He's like, challenge accepted.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, when he's singing opera and Quark comes into the Defiant Bridge and they have that conversation, I don't think that Quark had any idea that Worf was going to say yes to his proposal. I figured he thought he was probably going to get chucked out the airlock. And when Worf says yes, the look on Quark's face is fantastic, you know, because, you know, Worf has taken that challenge and he's going to prove to himself that he could win her heart, especially when he's been told he doesn't know anything about Klingon women. And I just really, really appreciate that these guys understand the character of Worf and his contradictions. It works so perfectly that he's going, challenge accepted. Exactly.
And he has such a crazed look in his eyes when he has Michael Dorn, when he's looking intently, you could see that he's looking almost to the distance as if he was on a Klingon battlefield, but you could just see in his mind the gears turning as if he is going to use Quark almost as like he's playing an online role playing game. He's going to take Quark. You know what? If I can't win this, I'm gonna turn this up to extra hard difficulty. I'm still gonna win her with Quark, with all these handicaps, with all these disadvantages, and he just takes it on with such, you know, the Worf, like the ultimate straight man, and he's such the straight man and such like a cranky square in this episode. Like, he outsquares himself so much, and I think when he has that look in his eyes, it's just hilarious because it's just him essentially just giving Quark, you know, this is what you say at dinner, but he's approaching it with like a martial demeanor and attitude, and it's hilarious.
I'm just waiting for Worf to run in going, Leroy Jenkins! like he's full on battle mode, you know, like he's just, it is awesome to watch him in this episode.
The,
and
the thing about his knowledge of Klingon culture and how to woo Klingon women, though, comes across a bit like everything with Worf, and it's why it's so great in DS9 when he finally gets with Martok, and through Martok he really learns more how to be a real Klingon and be a real warrior instead of being a textbook Klingon, as I feel like he is through the Next Generation, because he grew up on Earth and he doesn't have the experience of actually living on Kronos with Klingons. He talks about, he realizes which village or which province Grilka's from and what's customary there. And when he describes, you go in, you have the dinner, you go in with the leg of what is it, a leg of targ or a leg of whatever meat?
Linkta.
Linkta. And you put it on the table and then you knock everything off the table with it and you say, from this day forward, I want to provide food for your family. It just seems so corny. Like, if you were humans and you told some guy, okay, this is what you should do. And you should go over to her house, take a rose, take a nice bottle of a champagne, and then take the champagne and knock everything off the table with it. So not exactly
Make
that,
sure you're holding a boombox and stand there all night playing her favorite song.
Right. But it feels like something that he's heard, like this is what's traditional in that province. But if you actually did that in real life, all the other Klingon guys would go, dude, you did that? Really? You've got weak moves.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because from what we see from Worf, the extent of his knowledge of Klingon culture is almost solely derived from classic opera. Opera that I'm pretty sure most people don't even listen to, right?
So it'd be like if you based your entire life on Wagner. Right?
Exactly.
That's how you're going to approach everything.
I'm sure Klingon youth are listening to Klingon, the versions of, you know, Klingon rock and roll or hip hop or house music, but I'm all about the opera, and it has to be this particular staged moment. And you just understand like just how stunted he is, as if he's just reading, you know, Klingon Courting for Dummies for 25 years, and that's
all.
You
can see
the
cover of that.
Klingon Courting for Dummies. That's awesome. It reminds me, like, if a human being decided to, you know, court a woman but as if you were, you know, back in the 13th century and you were a knight and you were courting a lovely lady.
Right,
like,
right.
That's very much what I feel like this comes off as. That, and that makes sense since Klingons in a lot of ways are very Shakespearean in their demeanor, their love of opera still, and all of those kind of things. They feel like that kind of medieval idea of honor and duty and chivalry and all these kind of things wrapped up into one. So it kind of makes sense that this is still a thing, and the fact that Garoka does respond to this so well, you know, really shows where Klingon society when it comes to this kind of thing is, you know, especially a lady of her caliber. You know, I don't know if every Klingon woman would appreciate this. I don't see Kalar would appreciate this at all. You know, but a woman like this, you know, totally would.
Well, and B'Elanna would not appreciate this at all either.
No, no. If Tom did this to her, she'd, like, slap him.
And, like, Harry is giving, like, Tom advice to, like, some sort of, like, earpiece he just invented. Oh, man.
I don't really think that Harry gives anybody advice on relationships.
I hope not.
Especially after, because then, literally, you'd just be like, dude, you said no to 7 of 9. Shut up.
That's true. That's true.
Like, you don't know what you're talking about. You said no to 7. Shut up.
But to go back to your Shakespeare comment, Shakespeare is best when it's read in the original Klingon, right? So there is there's a through line with that.
Well, and to go back to your rock and roll comment, I mean, Elvis Presley, you've never experienced Elvis until you've listened to it in the original Klingon.
That's true.
See, I'm really surprised Matthew's not singing right now.
I already sang at the beginning, Chris. Okay. Maybe you'll tempt me into it later.
I don't.
You know, I have to, you know, make people wait for it, or else it's not special anymore.
It's all about the showmanship.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, we've already done all about the hair. We have.
I just love how it seems like non-humans in Star Trek have such bizarre mating rituals. So you have the Vulcans with their 7-year Ponfar and fighting and all of that. And then you have with the Klingons, obviously, you have, it seems that it's just totally normal for someone like Worf to knock someone random like Morn off his bar stool and insult the male companion of the woman he's trying to court. It just seems so. I think that's an extrapolation of how they present non-humans in Star Trek, is that everything is just completely ramped up on a different scale in terms of mating rituals and their societies and how they just operate. And I just think it's really interesting.
Well, with Ponfar, you can ask Droxine. It's 7 years, but it can be any time if you meet an especially pretty lady.
That's true. I was actually just writing an article about, you know, the 10 best Spock episodes, and as I was going through my selections, I was actually surprised that there's a number of episodes there, a surprising large amount of episodes where, like, Spock has a love interest or someone expresses interest in him, and it's ironic for someone that's supposed to be, you know, logical and emotionless that he gets into a lot of romantic relationships, even unintendedly. I think it's really funny.
Well, I would argue, and not to turn this into a Spock show, so we'll move on here, but I would argue he's not emotionless. Vulcans are not emotionless.
They just
keep their emotions in check. They're actually more emotional than we are. Well, while we're talking about Worf here, let's talk about the fact that he is riddled with contradictions, a great line by Jadzia when she tells him that he's not a traditional man. And I think that really shocks him because he definitely thinks of himself as a traditional Klingon, like the ideal Klingon. But he can't be. I mean, he grew up on Earth. He spent his career in Starfleet. He's always around people of other cultures. It's the same with us today. You know, I mean, I live abroad and I have for most of my adult life. And even before that, in university, I was always around international students. And so of all these influences coming into my life on a daily basis, and so I'm, you know, the farthest thing that you can find probably from a traditional American, even though I'm American. And it's the same for Worf. the environment he grew up in, there's no way that he can be a traditional Klingon, but he longs to be a traditional Klingon and has convinced himself that he is. But Jadzia, being just a straight shooter on this, tells him, you know, you're not a traditional Klingon. You drink prune juice for Kayless's sake.
I think that that is one of those things that is really interesting, because I think that Worf is a small picture of the entire Klingon Empire, because they are riddled with contradictions as well. I mean, they talk about honor all the time, and yet so many times we see things that are dishonorable, at least as we would understand that word, and even what we know of Klingons, they would kind of understand as being dishonorable. So I think that it's really nice to see that, like all societies, Klingons, like our own, are riddled with these strange contradictions that we just kind of hold side by side with each other, and we just let them go. And it's most interesting, too, because Worf is one of those characters in Star Trek who is longing to belong somewhere. And I think that's what made him fit on Deep Space Nine better than it did on TNG, is because on TNG, everybody belonged there except for Worf. Even Data, who... what he really wanted was to be like all of these people around him. You know, Worf was the one who was kind of on the outs, because what he really wanted in some ways was to be a true Klingon, to feel like he belonged as being a Klingon. And what Deep Space Nine finally gave him is an understanding with Martok of what it really meant to be a true Klingon. And I think that's what makes him such a dynamic character on Deep Space Nine as opposed to TNG. And what makes an episode like this really, really work is because Jadzia is that perfect person to kind of help bring that out in him and to help him be more okay with the fact that he's not the perfect Starfleet officer and or Klingon, that he's some sort of amalgamation of both, and that's okay, because that's who Worf is. It's okay for Worf to be an individual. He doesn't have to just be, you know, another, you know, classic Klingon, you know. And well, I think that's what's really, really interesting about the depth in this show, honestly, and even just this episode, strangely enough.
In terms of a visual of what you're talking about, when he comes into the bar, when he throws Morn off the bench, and he's showing off for Grilka, and he's going to make his challenge, but he's wearing the Starfleet uniform the whole time. I mean, that's quite a contrast for me visually, his behavior and the fact that he's in that Starfleet uniform, especially when you've got the Klingons in their warrior uniform, warrior garb at the table neighboring.
Absolutely. And I think the reason why this episode works and the reason why these characters work is because on a certain level, they're all outsiders. Grilka is an outsider when she became a widow. Quark is an outsider because he's a Ferengi who lives amongst, you know, humanoids and non-Ferengis most of the time. Worf is clearly an outsider, and Dax is the embodiment of the ultimate outsider as someone that has lived so many lives previously. So it's interesting that you have all these outsiders interacting in ways that the more traditional parts of their culture disapprove of. The Ferengis aspect disapprove of Quark and him kind of breaking out of the mold. Clearly the Klingon side of Worf is frustrated at Quark, and clearly Topak is chafing at, you know, Lady Grilka's growing infatuation with Quark. And, you know, you have Dax, who's the ultimate observer, the ultimate outsider, and she's trying to say, you know, I know more about being more of a nuanced Klingon than this Klingon next to me. And having all of them interplay with each other shows, I think, in Deep Space Nine, how they're willing to start to break out of the mold of TNG, that the Ferengis aren't just the Ferengis that we've assumed that they were.
Sure. Yeah,
and the point. Klingons aren't going to be the same types of Klingons. Grilka's a very different type of Klingon, let alone Worf.
Yeah.
Well, and what's really interesting, it reminds me of in Una McCormick's latest book, The Missing, she has Odo say this beautiful line to a Zenkathy, that Deep Space Nine has always been home for the homeless, and that it's kind of this, it's like the island for misfit toys. Uh-huh. You know, that's what Deep Space Nine is. And it really, really fits, you know, that all of these people who kind of come to this place with that where they need to grow, or they need to kind of, you know, Bashir, he needs to kind of have some of that ego shaved down. Sisko, he needs to, you know, what becomes of the brokenhearted? You know, it's literally just, that's the place where they've all come, and this place kind of morphs and changes them into new people. You know, this show is all about kind of like that rebirth and renewal in all of them. And so I think it's a really neat thing to see this play out in this episode this way. And I think you're right on, Will, with the fact that, you know, all these people are outsiders and they all come. And Deep Space Nine is, you know, the frontier town where all of the strange outsiders come to, you know, and that's the beauty of it, and what made it so different from all of the other shows that we had beforehand, and what makes it stand out and make it unique. And I think really makes it work in the end, because any one of us can have a character where we can be like, oh, I relate to them, and I relate to a part of them, you know, so we can see pieces of ourselves in all of these people.
Yeah.
And that's what's really, really cool.
Well, even the town itself is Cardassian, yet apart from Garrick,
right,
no
yeah.
one there is Cardassian. So everyone is an outsider within that
environment.
Except
for Garrick, and just plain, simple Garrick.
Plain, simple Garrick. That's right. Who, by the way, directed this episode?
That's right.
This was directed by Andy Robinson.
That's a really interesting thing to see. I really love his direction in this episode. I just like the way the whole thing looks. It has a softer feel to it. You know, mm-hmm. like I feel like even the lighting is a little bit softer. And the way it's shot and the things that he does really, really works well in everything there. And I almost sometimes feel like you can tell the episodes where a cast member has directed, because everybody's just a little bit looser, you know, yeah. and having a good, especially an episode like this, they're just having a good time. So, yeah, well done, Andy Robinson.
Well, I think here, I mean, it's a Cardassian station, and so naturally he would know how to shoot in a Cardassian environment better
than
anyone
else.
That is
very true.
So
he just creeps up on those camera angles. I mean that's a good point, because a lot of the scenes are in either the relatively closed confines of the Defiant, where they're just in the mess hall, they're just talking, they're kind of, you know, Dax is either has her foot up, or he's on the table, or they're just...
She learned that from Riker.
Exactly. with that swing. Or they're in Quark's bar, or they're in the holosuite, just very intimate environments that has, you know, that lighting, which feels very personal, as it should, because it's such a personal episode.
While we're on this subject, because I want to talk about the other O'Briens a bit as well, but let's stick with Worf here and the training that they do so that Quark can fight with the Bat'leth. This is all very entertaining, of course, and the performances by Terry Farrell and Armin Shimerman especially are entertaining. The device itself, is this not the worst possible design for if you're going to be swinging a Bat'leth around? The whole time you're watching it, you're like, you know, he's going to cut that thing off. And sure enough, whack.
It's version 1.0, Chris. They're still working out the kinks. I mean,
yeah.
She only had 10
minutes
to build
to come up with this
that.
In like a day, you know, so give her a break.
I was disappointed.
I mean, she's a genius, but...
I was disappointed at the end when Jadzia challenges Worf that she just went for a plain old Bat'leth. You know, Jadzia likes to really specify the weight, you know, the grip, the kind of material it's made of and all. She just said Bat'leth. I guess she was eager. She didn't want to waste any time. It's just computer
Bat'leth. She was
ready
to get down and dirty, Chris.
I like how the Bat'leth kind of floated too. It was floating before she grabbed it.
Yeah,
I was like, this is like a new program. We're just going to float for you to grab it.
This tiny force field, Will. especially with Quark, when the system goes down and he has to start making something up, and he makes up his poem. And of course, has the great line that we've talked about on the Orb before, Matthew, you know, the bats of love to hang by. But another thing he says here, actually, as we're talking about everyone coming to the station and working through their problems and changing, maybe DS9 is the place where they grow the kelp of discontent.
That was what I was wondering, is how we were going to get into the kelp of discontent. Because, goodness, that is... I mean, that whole speech, I don't know where where Quark is pulling any of this.
He had a seafood dinner before, so he was just thinking the ocean.
Yeah, is this a Zindi aquatic version of some sort of Shakespeare or something? Because the kelp of discontent.
Who had?
Are they looking for kelp cakes?
I mean, there's the original line, you know, the winters of my discontent, right? So it's so brilliant that it's just, it's like, I want to know, you know, the thinking that Armin Shimerman was having when he was coming up with that line, whether it was premeditated or he just kind of came up with a motif. He just said the ocean and let's just kind of go with it. And then he throws in bats at the very end. And of course, Gurkha, they're Klingons. They're not familiar with, at least I'm assuming, so they're not familiar with bats or kelp. So they just think it's this bizarre thing, but somehow it's appropriate to Ferengi. Somehow it's internally consistent with Ferengi culture. So they respect it because he did respect our customs, so we need to respect his, and it's delivered so well.
Well, it's the way you say it, Will. It's like the Blues Traveler's song, Hook, off the album 4, where he says, it doesn't matter what I say as long as I say it with inflection.
It's true.
It just, you know, the hook brings you back. It doesn't matter what Quark is saying. It's just the presentation of it. Gurkha feels like, oh, this must be something profound. We should respect the Ferengi culture. And, you know, I've never seen the actual script. I've seen the transcript, of course, but I haven't seen the actual script for this episode. So I don't know if all that was written out or, as you say, it was like a theme and Armin, you go do something. It comes across almost as Armin just kind of making it up on the spot because it's so random. It's just stuff that, how do you write that in the first place?
It could have just been a weird Elton John song.
And for it to come off the way it does, it has to feel random. Because he's, you know, he's on the spot. Like, what do I do? What do I do?
And when he first says, you know, rite of proclamation, you're like, that sounds totally plausible. That sounds totally plausible.
Well, that's a real thing, I think, yeah.
In the right, and then he goes into this complete, you know, non sequitur. And can we just take a moment to also comment on how great his physical acting was when he was moving the batholith?
Yeah.
You know, when I was reading the Memory Alpha, it mentioned that he had hired a mime coach to train him, to teach him how to do that. And the physical acting with that is just so brilliant. And he totally sells those movements and all of it. It's just wonderful.
And when he comes over, he says, now I'm just going to put this down here.
Yeah.
And then give it. It's like, whose line is it anyway when they're doing that? They have the audience members come up and they move.
Oh,
like
yeah.
Ryan around, you know. It's like that. And you're just making whatever they do, you've got to quickly come up with a line to explain it. That's exactly how that felt. And it was pulled off so well.
And how at the very end, when, you know, he's clearly trying to go on longer with this kelp speech. And then it kicks up back in. He's like, oh, I guess we're fighting again. I guess we're going back to this. It's so, the timing is perfect.
When he's like, enough talking.
I know. I like
and
that.
And now for the fighting.
Just stalling for time. Okay, enough.
And I'm done with my ridiculous speech.
And then Worf says, I don't know how he's doing it, but somehow he's still alive.
Exactly. That was so funny. There are so many lines in this episode. Again, I've seen this episode hundreds of times, but I'm watching it again before this show. And I'm again just laughing out loud at a lot of the lines delivered by various characters, whether it's Worf or it's Odo or Jadzia or Bashir or whoever in this episode. If for something to make you laugh after you've seen it so many times is really well written and well performed.
I think it's because all of the situations, no matter how many times you watch it, are always still funny.
Yeah.
You know, and that's difficult to do, you know, over time to really keep something still be funny. And, you know, especially the more you've watched it, the more you kind of love these characters, I think even the funnier it gets because the more you watch, say, a character like Worf, you really start to pick up on the nuances that Michael Dorn puts into his performance, especially the humor that he adds to a lot of things that you might not catch on, say, your first or second viewing. But you get to that third, fourth, fifth, 100th viewing, you're really seeing just how well these people know these characters at this point.
And with Michael
especially,
Dorn.
Especially... Yeah, Michael Dorn, who's been on, I mean, he's the person who has the longest running character in any, you know, series.
And so much of his humor is delivered through very subtle facial expressions or movements.
Well, I mean, even the fact I love in this episode, it's one of the very few times you see Michael Dorn touch his Klingon forehead.
Oh, right.
But when he puts his hand on his forehead, kind of like when we do as humans, when we're frustrated and we're like kind of banging our own forehead, the fact that he does that, it's a nice little touch of just showing how frustrated and annoyed he is at this whole situation. But he's still going to go forward with it because he's got to prove himself.
And the way he does it, he's standing up and he has his arms crossed. He's like this and he's holding a pad in his hand. It just reminds me of, you know, he's like a frustrated drama teacher. He's trying to teach Quark these lines.
Right. Yeah.
He's like, for the 100th time, that is not how it goes. Let me do it. But he can't do it because he's the teacher, right? And just the way he goes like this, it's not even a full face palm. It's just like, let me touch my Klingon ridges. Just get that pressure out. It's so well done.
Well, before we leave this topic completely and go to the O'Briens, I also like Jadzia's line near the end when she says, at least they're on the same wavelength. Because her frustration comes out. It's like, Worf, come on. You know, ever since you said nice hat, I've been trying to get your attention. And now I'm helping you hook up Quark with a Klingon who you think's glorious. Wake up already.
What I love about this too is it's that classic, like, somebody's being friend-zoned, you know, that doesn't want to be, and finally makes, you know, has the guts to make the move. And that, of all the people on the show, to see Jadzia be friend-zoned by a male is just, you know, we're just not used to seeing it. Obviously, Bashir would have jumped at the chance. And, you know, anybody else on the station would just be ludicrous to say no to Jadzia. Come on.
Do you think Harry would have said no to Jadzia if he had been stationed at DS9?
He's that dumb. Yeah, he would have said no. He wouldn't have known how to handle
that. He has
a
girl waiting back home.
Yeah, come on, dude. Gosh. Yeah, he might never get home, but he's got a girl back there who's still waiting for him. Wink, wink.
And the irony is that Garrett Wang in real life is the exact opposite of Harry Kim. Like the exact
opposite. I'm sure. Yeah.
It's hilarious.
But I love that because, you know, the whole thing about Jadzia there and her having to, I feel like, work so hard to get Worf's attention is just hysterical because honestly, normally she should be able to snap her fingers and have, you know, 10 men line up to be like, and don't tell me you have a wonderful personality. I'll take you. And it's Morn. So, because she likes his hairs on his head.
No one ever tells Worf, though, you have a wonderful personality.
Yeah, that's true. So I think that's just, again, it's really great writing to watch her just be on that other side, being friend-zoned by Worf.
Well, let's shift gears to the B story here to close out our discussion and talk about the other O'Briens. And one thing we haven't, well, Matthew, when we talked about this on the Orb, we actually talked about the other O'Briens specifically in an episode called The Best Massages Kira's Ever Had. We were speculating about the situation with Keiko as well. And one thing, well, listener Ruth Ward pointed out to us afterwards that one thing that we didn't pick up on that could be going on here is that Keiko could be feeling guilty about the fact that she cannot carry the baby. And that's why she's so understanding and actually pushing Miles to go down to Bajor with Kira there at the end because she doesn't want the baby to be put in danger, I suppose. But any new thoughts on that? And especially, Will, what are your thoughts on that? Because you did not discuss it with us.
I think that's a really good point. I'm glad you brought up Ruth because actually I was going to bring her up as well. I think it's a combination of feeling guilty, but I think it's also, you know, I was talking to my wife about this and she actually watched this episode with me last night and she had this perspective and I think it's very valid. She said that, you know, when Keiko had that baby, you know, when that was transferred to Kira, to Nerys, you know, she felt a loss, although, you know, the baby is still alive. She's going to be carried to term. Keiko as a mother, she has lost that connection to her child.
Yeah.
And maybe it's not so much guilt as it's a sense of she has lost that connection. And the only way that she can have any type of connection is through Kira now. So she is compensating as best she can. and in the only way that you can, in making sure that Kira is taken care of, almost to the point of being pampered, because that's the only thing she can do, because she literally can't care for this baby that was in her own womb for so long. I think, you know, all those things that she's pushing, you know, Miles to do is just out of that sense of, I need to do something, and this is the only thing I can do right now, is to make sure you're comfortable. And obviously that might have put her in a blind spot in terms of seeing some of the feelings that Miles and Nerys are, you know, it's there right underneath the surface. And maybe she is so consumed with the fact that she doesn't have that connection. She needs to support her. She's not seeing what's happening. And I think it's just very deft and it's very well played. And I think, you know, Ron Moore said that this story, this B plot, is something he's even more proud of than the A plot, which is wonderful. But the fact that this was just so, you know, it happens in real life. It happens in all of our lives. And the fact that they're able to do it in Deep Space Nine, I think, is just fantastic.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I think it's probably the best way to look at the storyline, because otherwise you're just like, what the heck is wrong with Keiko? Stop pushing your husband on another woman. Because it's just automatic for you to start to have feelings for somebody that you spend that much personal time with. And you know, what O'Brien and Kira are doing is very intimate. You know, and it's hard to not to start to have feelings for somebody when you know, as they're doing it. Obviously, it seems like, you know, the whether he's helping her out of the tub or, you know, giving her a massage or whatever, they're talking, they're getting to know each other in the kind of the ways that you would if you first started meeting somebody and getting to know them and you start sharing intimate moments together. So, yeah, everything that they're doing is exactly what he'd probably be doing to Keiko if she was the one that was pregnant, giving her the massages, helping her out of the tub. And now it's been transferred, so it really is like he has his work wife. But literally this time, it's not just his work wife. She's also carrying his baby, so there's a connection there. So it creates, I think, a really interesting storyline that Star Trek tells here about what can happen in a marriage when, you know, one spouse starts to get too close to somebody of the opposite sex and how careful we have to be in that. You know, we have to guard, you have to guard our hearts from that happening, you know, not start sharing that personal intimate time with people that are of the opposite sex, or, you know, having those kind of in-depth conversations. Those should be reserved for our spouses. Why? Because you can start to have feelings for somebody else when you shouldn't, and we have to be careful. I really like that. I think it's a well-done adult story in that sense for Star Trek to tell. And it's done without being like titillating or ridiculous or over the top. It's just very subtle, very honestly felt. I think it's fantastic for Star Trek to kind of show us the right thing to do in such a very subtle way.
It's presented in a very realistic way. The place where this B story suffers, in my opinion, is that this could be the A story of another episode where we could actually explore more of what's going on, particularly with Keiko's role in the situation. Because unless you really sit down and you think about this a lot, as we have, on first viewing or just casual viewing, it does come off quite odd, Keiko's behavior. And as you were saying, Matthew, it is a very important topic. And so for it to be the B plot in the story doesn't give them enough time to really flesh that out. It is nice that they presented the situation. I do think that it could have been told better, though.
Yeah, I think that's endemic of how the writers treated Keiko as a character. And I think she is probably the most woefully underwritten character in Deep Space Nine. And when you just take a look at Keiko as a character, she has so much potential as, you know, the wife of Miles, but also as potentially her own character, her own agency, you know, as a mother, as a botanist, as a civilian in a new sector of space. The fact that they didn't do very much with her, the fact that she was always just this ancillary character. And then even in this episode, like you mentioned, Chris, that it could have been developed into a really great A story, but the fact that it was still a B story, and because it was rushed, Keiko again didn't get that type of development. Yeah. I think speaks to the writer's overall feelings towards Keiko.
Well, and when you talk about the writing of Keiko, the fact that we never really got to know her as a character, even though she was on TNG and then DS9, means when we get to this point, we don't have the background or the framework of their relationship really to factor into what's going on. Exactly. If we knew more about the O'Briens, the real O'Briens, not the other O'Briens, when we get to this point, then the whole thing may have played differently. And maybe some of it would have made more sense without the need for them to fill it in more.
It is a terrible trope on television that somebody in a show either has kids or they get married to somebody, but they're not really an important part necessarily of the rest of the storylines for the show. So they don't get seen very much. And it's one of the few places I think Deep Space Nine really fails in the character development is with Keiko and O'Brien and showing those two in their marriage, because it was a place where they could have done something completely different. And it was one of the great parts of putting, you know, Worf and Jadzia together, because they are main characters on the show. And therefore, you know, when you put them together, you can do those storylines and people don't feel like they're kind of losing something by just watching these ancillary characters, which is funny because, again, on Deep Space Nine, we watch a lot of ancillary characters. Yeah. So it's disappointing that they never did more with the O'Briens, and I'm talking about the main O'Briens, Keiko and Miles. And when they did, a lot of times Keiko does come off not so great.
No, I mean, she comes off as the nagging wife a lot of the time, which I think it doesn't do any service to the character or the stories that she's in. Right. It's kind of surprising that she's written that way so often.
Yeah, it's definitely the classic falling into a trope. And, you know, the fact that she's a botanist, that she doesn't have to be defined by her relationship with a male character.
Yeah.
I mean, it blows my mind that they couldn't, you know, figure out a way for a botanist to go into the Gamma Quadrant and have her own set of adventures and her own story to tell. You know, it was there for the taking.
So, so you're proposing the next series, Star Trek Keiko.
Absolutely.
I mean, Star Trek Botany.
I mean, yeah. I mean,
and not the Botany Bay.
Exactly.
Coming soon to the Home and Garden Channel.
I think, you know.
Welcome to HGTV.
I think, like, on a more, like, you know, on a serious note, I think the fact that the reason why I love Deep Space Nine is that it has that civilian perspective, and you know, the fact that Keiko isn't part of Starfleet, doesn't want to join Starfleet, but still exists in this environment, in this future. There's still a lot of ripe storytelling to be told there. It's how I feel about the boomers in Enterprise, right? There's a complete other, you know, perspective that's very unique and has a lot of potential that we don't see. And, you know, it may take the form of Keiko and, you know, and Botany, but also could take the form of a whole bunch of other things too.
You know, what's a little bit sad is the fact that O'Brien is married, and that in this episode, you know, I really like the chemistry that he and Nana have together. I think they work really well together. And it would have been so interesting if, you know, he hadn't been married in TNG to have had that kind of be a relationship that played out somehow. Because they are such kind of like fire and ice.
Yeah.
And that makes for great couples on TV, you know. And it just would have been kind of fun to see that. So for me, in another universe, in an alternate universe, it's actually, you know, Miles and Kira that are together. And it would be a really interesting story to have like a myriad universe kind of short story or something where those two are together.
So if they got married, would she be O'Brien Nerys?
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
She'll take the Irish name, but she'll keep the Bajoran structure.
Yeah, maybe.
How would Odo feel about all of this? I mean, he would just be ripping into Miles all the time, right?
Yeah.
Of course, the Bajoran structure has always seemed normal to me because that's the same naming structure that we have in Japan. It's always family name first.
So you're Jones Christopher?
Actually, I am.
You call him Dr. Jones, doll!
I am Jones Christopher.
That is really interesting.
Well, let's start to wrap up here with our final thoughts about the episode and any other point that you want to mention that we didn't cover yet. And, of course, the all-important rating of the episode. So, Will, what are your final thoughts and your rating?
So, in the Babel Conference, Caper Simmons actually had a line just last night, actually, I think actually applies to Worf in this episode. He called Worf Captain Kronos paragon of literary Klingon virtue. And it's so fitting because that's who he views himself, this just ultra idealized version of a Klingon hero. And this is the first time he's starting to really break out of it. And it's ironic that, you know, a Trill woman is the one that disabuses him of the notion of what a true Klingon is, in the same way that Quark is the one that kind of is able to establish a relationship with Grilka. And I think that even without Worf's intervention, Grilka and Quark would have still had a romantic relationship that they consummated. It may have taken a different form, it may have taken longer, but they still had that connection. And so this just goes back to my original point that the start of the episode is, this is just an episode of outsiders and how they are breaking out of the mold and expectations of what they're supposed to be and how they're supposed to act around one another. And with the B story with the O'Briens is just another facet of realism. The fact that this station is a home. People live here.
Yeah.
And these, you know, they have families, there are marriages, these things happen. You know, this could be a storyline in Parenthood. I know Matthew loves that show, but this is a storyline that can happen in Parenthood or any other story, right? The type of intimacy that is becoming kind of dangerous or kind of tricky. So it just works on so many levels because these characters feel like you can hang out with them, you could relate with them in a way that, you know, especially TNG, because TNG, they couldn't even do basic romance, right? Let alone, you know, an odd couple holodeck fight scenario with, you know, a situation where your wife's baby's in another person, right? So the fact that they could do it with such, you know, admittedly a silly plot, but still make it work is just speaks volumes to just how the characters are developed so much more at Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, definitely. Well said. What's your rating for the episode?
I'm going to give it 5 out of 5 O'Brien neck massages.
Okay, those are very good.
Man, I could use one of those right now.
It's a family secret.
Yeah. You know, I think that I was talking to a friend tonight, actually. I think that this show, this series, has the most relatable characters on it before we get to Enterprise. They're the most human. They have the most real life lives that we've seen. You know, they have everyday concerns, whether it's their families or their friends or somebody they like that's not liking them back. I mean, literally, it's like Star Trek High School Musical. They just never had a musical episode. And
episode on DS9, though, remember?
That would have been, can't you just see him going,
wait, seriously?
We're all in this together, you know, and having, you know, Worf dance. get the Quark shimmy there.
Go listen, goodness. Go listen, Will, to the Orb episode called A Nausicaan Musical. We talk about their desire to have a musical episode on there.
Is it like that show, like Cop Rock? Would have been like that.
Oh, God. So, you know, I really, really appreciate an episode like this where the characters are just going through something that's normal and everyday. I mean, it's not life-altering in the sense of, like, there's a war going on, and the universe is not going to explode in this episode. None of that's happening. It's all about getting to understand the background and what's going on inside all of these characters. And at the same time, too, just letting them let loose and have a great time. And so, honestly, I don't think I could rate this episode highly enough. So I'm going to give it 5 out of 5 sexually frustrated trills.
Wow. Okay. Spicy rating there.
Oh, man.
All right. So, you guys have covered everything quite well. And it's a great episode for character development for so many characters, especially the main characters that we've talked about, Worf and Jadzia, Quark, not necessarily Grilka, because this is, of course, the last part of the Quark and Grilka arc, so we don't get to see her again, but also for Miles and Kira as well, and could have been for Keiko, but we didn't go there. There are a few other things in here. First of all, when Jadzia says her, it reminded me of Arrested Development. Do you remember George Michael's girlfriend, Anne? And so Michael Bluth would always go, her?
Huh? Who? Egg?
Also, Matthew, we talk often about how, of all the Star Trek series post-TOS, DS9, they are the writers who most like to reference the original series. And that happens in this episode. If you noticed, Quark refers to having to learn all of this Klingonese, not Klingon.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A nice little TOS nod. It's
like
there.
Vietnamese, right?
Yeah, they're very similar, actually.
Very.
So that was a nice little nod to TOS there. And also one other note, which I'm sure this one you have to kind of dig around and learn about the actors a bit. Phil Morris, who I already said played Jackie Chiles on Seinfeld, who plays Thopak in here, he was in the episode Miri, another TOS connection from this episode. He's a kid in an army helmet in the scene when all the kids are surrounding Kirk in Miri.
Wow.
So good TOS connections in this episode, plus a great fun DS9 story. So I'm going to give this one 9 Maparian L's with just a hint of Pazifer.
Oh, you remembered, Chris.
You may not make a good warrior, Chris, but you make an excellent bartender.
Well, thank you. All right. Well, Will, thanks for joining us today for the discussion. I'm glad we could get you on for some DS9. So tell everyone where they can find you around the network and around the interwebs.
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Will_Nguyen. It's spelled N-G-U-Y-E-N. I'm also the content coordinator for the network, so if any ideas on what we want to talk about, just drop me a line. And I've just actually started writing for TrekNews.net, so you can find me on there as well.
Excellent. Very good. And people can catch you on Warp 5.
Oh, and of course, every week in the Decon Chamber.
Or in the conference room.
Yeah, we've named it the conference room now.
You guys are moving around the ship a bit more now, right? You're not always recording in the Decon Chamber anymore.
Well, it's because Phlox won't let them have Plomeek soup in the Decon Chamber.
Someone could get burned, Matthew. You know.
That is true. And when you're only wearing your underwear, it's going to hurt.
Exactly.
I just love how we say the conference room in the same intonation as the Decon Chamber, as if it's this exotic thing, but it's a conference room.
So join us once again here in the conference room for another episode of Warp 5.
That's exactly how Norman says it. It's hilarious.
Chris, it is so funny. We have talked on the Orb now twice about this episode.
That's right.
And now we're doing it on the Ready Room together. And every time I feel like we're not really repeating ourselves. We have a lot to talk about with this episode.
Yeah, we might be repeating ourselves a bit, but we find some new things to talk about too.
Yeah, but it's just so much fun of an episode to talk about. And, you know, I was struck by new things watching this episode. Just randomly thinking about the idea, what would it be like to have a Trill friend who has been a female and a male, you know, so that when you comment, like Worf does, on the gloriousness of Grilka, when Terry Farrell's character looks at her, she can judge from a male and a female perspective of her beauty, which is so interesting. And then, of course, when she's like, she's all right, it's because you can tell that Terry Farrell's like, bro, do you not realize that I kind of want to jump your bones right now?
And it also, maybe that's a little bit of, because Curzon was so into the Klingons, that's a little bit of Curzon saying, her, she's okay.
I mean, I've had better as Curzon, just saying.
That's right, Curzon. Tell us those stories.
In fact, his Klingon ladies looked like the ladies from the Romulan comics that we did with John Byrne.
Oh, gosh.
That's what his, that's what his ladies looked like. So if you all missed that, please go back to Literary Treks, and when we did John Byrne's Romulan series, you'll understand what you're talking about.
Yeah. All right. Well, it was great to have Will on as well to talk about this with us today, but it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
It's not an overstatement, and you had said in your introduction that without him and his hand guiding all of this, then it's unlikely that 2 would have been what it was. And if it had not been successful, then it probably would have meant the end of Star Trek at that point.
Earl Grey.
Like, I'm expecting Ricardo Martaban to, like, walk around the corner and be like, Captain Picard, welcome.
This is Risa 5!
The shuttlecraft. The shuttlecraft.
The orb.
Curzon is involved with the Khitomer Quartz. Spock is at Khitomer when those are being talked about, so you would think they would have run into each other.
They probably hung out in the bar together.
To the journey! One guy's like, why don't we just write better stories for Wesley? And then the lead writer's like, you out now! The Ready Room.
The movie series would not have relaunched and become what it was if not for the amazing bounce of The Wrath of Khan. The Wrath of Khan was to Star Trek the same thing that The Best of Both Worlds was to Next Generation.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
It's also the end of a character and a thing that is really about how death is just a part of life. And that while there's an end, it doesn't mean that it's the end.
Literary Treks.
Well, I've always liked the... I like that episode for... I mean, it's one of the most derided of the original series episodes, but yet I always have this place in my heart for some reason. I've always enjoyed watching it over. So I wanted to do something with those guys, the Scalbians.
The 602 Club. Like, I could kind of dismiss Droids in Distress and Fight or Flight and everything like that, and I was just kind of watching the background, but all of a sudden I started catching myself, like, stopping working and just focusing on watching. And so it just got better and better and better. And I think I was hooked by episode 4, Breaking Ranks. That's when I was like, okay, I like this show. This is good. Warp 5.
In the history of Axanar, Alec Peters and Christian Gossett wrote a section of the history dealing with the Arcanus campaign. And in the Arcanus campaign, a majority of Starfleet ships were destroyed.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what else we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find our shows everywhere that you get your podcasts. Of course, we're in iTunes, where we have our huge artist section. Thank you, Apple. And you can also find us on Spreaker, TuneIn, Windows Phone, SoundCloud, BlackBerry. Pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts, you're going to find Trek FM there. You can also go to the website, stream from the show page, download the MP3 file, grab the RSS link. And while you're over there on iTunes or Stitcher, please take a moment and leave us a rating and a written review. We love to hear what you think about the show. And also, your reviews make it easier for other Star Trek fans to find our shows, and they also help us rise up in the search results in iTunes. So please take a moment to do that. We really appreciate it. Another way that you can help us out is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. We are a listener-supported network, and it's thanks to the generous support of all of our patrons that we're able to bring these shows to you every single day. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, you can set any amount that you would like to contribute on a month-to-month basis, and that helps us pay for production and hosting and distribution and equipment and everything that we need to bring high-quality Star Trek discussion to you every day of the week. We really thank everyone who is supporting us over there, and we'd also like to thank especially our associate producer here on the Ready Room, Renee Roberts. She is a huge supporter of the network and has been almost since the very beginning. I am so happy that we have Renee with us, and you can find her on Twitter at @Mares_1701. That's Mares, like the character in the animated series, _1701. And Renee, thank you so much. As I always tell you, for everything that you do for us here on the network, I really, really appreciate it. So, Matthew, we talked about Dan Madsen today in news. We talked about the Wrath of Khan steelbook. And, of course, we talked about Deep Space Nine. So, I would like to hear from our listeners about what they think on these topics. What is the best way for them to get in touch with us?
Chris, you would do that at trek.fm/contact. You can choose a show and you could write us a message that way. So you could choose the Ready Room or any of the other shows that you wanted to contact. But, you know, really one of the best ways to do that is on the Babel Conference these days. We just have fantastic conversations over there. That's our listener only discussion group. You do have to ask to be a part of the group. We'll let you in, and you get to be a part of all the great discussions that are going on, from Star Trek to everything else that we've been talking about on Trek FM. It's really the place to be, and we have some just fantastic conversations there that I don't think are really being had on any other message boards like that. So I hope that you'll join us, because we really want you to be there and just join in the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is all in Facebook. So the way you get there is to type B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up. Or go to our website and click discussion up there on the menu bar. That will take you there as well. Just click join, and we'll let you right on into the group as soon as we see your request. And we've had just a steady stream of people joining recently, Matthew. We've got, I think we're closing in on about 500 people just in that group, which makes for great conversation.
It really does. So if you want to have great Star Trek talk, this is the place to be, the Babel Conference on Facebook.
Absolutely. All right. And then also, if you want to send us a voicemail, we do have an option for that as well. If you go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. You can record using the mic on your smartphone or your tablet or your computer. Upload it right there from the page to me, and maybe I can play that on a future show. Matthew, if people want to find you around the network, you know, when you're not sitting there all, you know, falling in love with a Grilka and trying to maybe toss Morn out of a bar stool as well, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, that does take up a lot of my time these days, but when I'm not busy with that and I have time to look at my phone, you can always get in touch with me on Twitter at MattRushing02. And then, of course, I do a few shows here on the network as well. I've got The Orb with you, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine. So if you enjoy the conversation that we had here, we, like I said, have talked about this episode a couple of times, so you can check those out, as well as all the other talk that we have about the show. And then I do Literary Treks with Dan Gunther, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek. And honestly, Chris, that's been so much fun. We've had 3 episodes in a row with author interviews. So we had Una McCormick, then we had John Jackson Miller, and we've had Keith DeCandigo as well. So it's just been fantastic over there, having a great time talking about, you know, the only place these days to get all sorts of things, whether it's the 24th century universe or more Spock adventures. I mean, it's the place to be. And then, of course, doing the 602 Club. We just pick a geeky topic each week and have a great time talking about it. And so friends from the network drop by, great hosts from the network as well. It's just a place to have a great time talking about some things that don't revolve around Star Trek. So now, Chris, when you're not trying to find ways to lure Janzia over to your place so y'all can get down, where can we find you?
Well, I will tell you, Matthew, it would not take me as long to realize the signals that she was sending as it took Worf.
Chris, I know you pretty well after, you know, 2 years of podcasting together. I don't think it would take you that long. I have more faith in you, my friend.
Absolutely. Also, before I tell you where to find me, you were talking about Morn sitting at the bar. I was just picturing, Matthew, that if Deep Space Nine were shot today, in this episode, Morn is sitting there. He's got the glass in his hand. He's swishing it around. He's asking for another one. I think he would be sitting there staring at his iPhone.
That would be awesome. Can you imagine, like, he's like trying to tweet, you know, or something like that? And he just knocks the phone out of his hand and throws him on the ground.
Maybe he's rating Quark's bar on Yelp.
That'd be awesome. Intergalactic Yelp.
All right. Well, if you want to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. You can also find me in the Babel Conference on Facebook. And then I have relaunched my blog on my website. And I actually took all my old content offline and put up a post that said I want a fresh start. And so I'm trying to start writing some new and different things bit by bit. So if you want to find that, you can find my post about Leonard Nimoy on there and my thoughts on his passing. And then I'll have new content coming up soon. And that's at cbrianjones.com. Again, Brian with a Y. And then here on the network, you can find me, as Matthew mentioned, on The Orb talking Deep Space Nine. And you can also find me on Hyperchannel, where I bring you some Star Trek news, usually once or twice a week. And just as news comes up, I put those shows out. Well, Matthew, I think that's everything we need to cover in today's show. So I'm going to head back down and eavesdrop on the O'Briens a little bit because, you know, the stuff they talk about in that room, it's actually better than most TV shows.
Well, Chris, don't bring your kids because there's some pretty salty language that happens in those arguments. So I'd just be careful.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Chris, it's time to stick a discontented kelp cake in it because the ready room is done.